This is Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Frank Joklik in Salt Lake City on January 20th, 1994. All right.
And so when, you know, when the end of the year approached in 1963, we were really beginning to be optimistic that we were onto something major. We had carried out reconnaissance of the environs of Mount Whaleback. And when I say environs, I mean within a radius of 100 miles or so. We'd carried out a helicopter reconnaissance. In very difficult flying conditions, very high temperatures, which reduced the lifting capabilities of the helicopter, and very often strong winds in the range of 20 to 50 miles an hour. But we had to make sure that we weren't missing any major bids, any major bets in the surrounding areas that we should go after. And we didn't identify very important iron ore deposits in the Wheelie Wally area, which is northwest of Mount Newman, and also identified other deposits which were drilled and evaluated much later. The first inkling that we got that our theory of surface enrichment mightn't hold water came quite early in 1964 when we decided to carry a hole down, and by then we had capability to go down several hundred feet. We carried a hole down to 500 feet and stayed in high-grade iron ore all the way. You see, it may seem strange why we hadn't done this before, but the drilling was very difficult because in the Brockman iron formation, in this jaspilite, you got leached areas that formed caverns, and of course with the rotary percussion drill, you stopped getting air return and lost the hole. And this happened all the time. But here was a place where we managed to stay in fairly massive material all the way, got good air return, went down 500 feet, and were in relatively high-grade iron ore all the way.
Diamond drilling?
Rotary percussion drilling. But we also supplemented that with a couple of diamond rigs. Mm-hmm. But we used them more for stratigraphic control than for actually proving up the tonnage, because the rotary drilling was quicker than the diamond drilling by a factor of maybe 10.
It's very expensive to do this drilling, isn't it?
Oh yeah, sure. Yes, we were writing checks as if the end of the world was about to come. Early in 1964, things were tough for Pam on the home front because I was traveling up to the project once or twice a month on these long trips. I was also looking at other exploration opportunities in Australia as a sideline, examining gold deposits and prospecting for other materials. In addition to that, I was doing periodic trips back to New York. So I was away from home certainly more than 50, perhaps as high as 70% of the time. And
meanwhile, there was a new baby.
Exactly, which came in January. And
63.
We were in January 64.
Oh, 64.
We're into 64 now.
That's right.
And we were breaking new ground there too in this baby rearing business. In fact, I remember Pam came home from hospital with the baby, and we knew that you had to wrap a baby, you know, and little Carl was crying a lot the first few days, and we couldn't figure out quite why, but then we put together the fact that the temperature was about 100 degrees, and he was developing heat rashes, and that was the reason he was crying. But another important event, of course, towards the change of years, turn of years from 63 to 64, was the murder of Jack Kennedy on November 23rd of 1963, which caused big waves in Australia, tremendous interest. The Australians just couldn't fathom such a thing, that a president of a stable, civilized country like the United States would be murdered. That was a topic of discussion in all the pubs. We, in our exploration of Mount Newman, were under the impression that we really had to have something to give the Japanese by the middle of the year of 64 in order to remain competitive with Hammersley and Goldsworthy. And what the Japanese were after, of course, was ore that ran better than 63% iron and was suitably low in sulfur and phosphorus. And above all, they were after lump ore, because they were being offered fines from other locations in the world. But for their blast furnaces, they wanted lump ore plus 6 millimeters, minus 30 millimeters. Material that would not need sintering. They'd save themselves the cost of sintering. Well, we made a calculation of the ore reserves that we had early in 1964, and we figured we were over 100 million tons then of ore of that quality, but that was clearly not enough to put forward a meaningful offer to the Japanese. Because what we were totally at sea about was what kind of annual production rate we might be asked to supply. We were thinking in terms of maybe 5 million tons a year. Well, with 100 million tons, that'd be 20 years supply, and that seemed a little bit thin to attract acceptance by the Japanese. So about that time, we started to put a drift into the eastern portion of Mount Whalebank. We began a 700-foot tunnel, and subsequently, of course, that became our showpiece, because not many feet from the adit, we ran into high-grade, beautiful blue-gray saw massive hematite, and stayed in it for 600 feet or so.
Where was the outcrop? What side of the...
Marvelous demonstration. Well, the outcrop, Lee, was the Mount Whalebank itself. Mount Whalebank was about 2 miles long and half a mile wide, and rose 700 or 800 feet from the plain level, and you could find iron ore on most places on the surface, but you didn't know what were small concentrations and what were larger concentrations. And we finally defined two separate deposits, one on Mount Whaleback East, the other on the western portion of Mount Whaleback. And this tunnel went in several hundred feet above plain level on the eastern part of Mount Whaleback. Well, not long after that, I got Charles Court to inspect the deposit. Now, Charles Court was the Minister for Industrial Development in Western Australia at that time. The Premier of Western Australia was Sir David Brand, a very imposing, kindly statesman, came from a farming background, extremely solid citizen. But the man who was concerned in dealing with the iron ore companies was Charles Court. Now, Charles Court became one of the most famous politicians in Australia, virtually was at that time. He was a strong man physically, a very, very handsome guy, articulate, but very prone to come to the point quickly. He was a hard-driving, hands-on individual, reputed to have a short fuse. It was difficult to get on side, but once you had him on side, you had a formidable ally. And I remember from my first visits to his office, when he got to his office, he'd always get up and say, "What can I do for you?" And it took me a while to realize that he expected a very concise, to the point answer to that question. And once you'd said your little piece, then he would take over and quickly tell you what he thought of your request or your proposal. Mm-hmm. We became strong allies or close allies and very good friends over time, but he was a man not to be trifled with, as I found when I brought him up to Mount Whaleback there and we went to inspect the tunnel. And as we were walking out of the tunnel, I remained behind to talk to the contractors for about 5 or 10 minutes. And then when I got to the portal, there was Mr. Court, clearly in a state of rising agitation at having been kept waiting. So he gave me his point of view on a number of points regarding the development of Mount Whaleback on which we had differed. And he hopped in the Land Rover, and as we drove down the very rocky track down to the base of the mountain, the noise level of our conversation rose and rose and rose, and the more it rose, the faster I drove, so we were sort of bumping along, hitting the roof of the Land Rover and yelling at each other. Well, after a while, I began to understand, as we drove along, what he was getting at, and he began to understand what I was getting at. And by the time we got back to camp, we were back to perfectly normal, and we'd had our little contretemps, and as I say, we afterwards our relationship became a very smooth one, and we had to cover a lot of ground, because what needed to be done was to negotiate an agreement with the government of Western Australia for the development of this iron ore deposit. You see, The only title we had was these temporary reserves covering the discoveries that we'd made. But all this did was to permit you to go on the ground and do your exploration, and when you felt you had defined a mineable deposit, then you had to go to Perth and negotiate an agreement for the development. This was not the case, say, for small gold mines in Kalgoorlie, where you staked claims and the rules for developing and mining those claims were very clearly defined in the Mining Act. But for the development of major resources like that, discovering square miles and requiring the development of infrastructure facilities in the area, this all had infrastructure, and then, as you pointed out, a railroad and a port and so on. This required a pretty far-ranging mm-hmm. agreement. I have to backtrack just a little bit here and say that as the news of our proving up these reserves got to head office in New York, they began to think in terms of the numbers, the major capital investment likely to be needed. And the board of AMAX was by no means uniformly in favor of spending a lot of money on developing iron ore deposits a long way, halfway around the world, in northwestern Western Australia. And particularly the people who held strong sway on the AMAX board at the time were the Hochschilds, Walter and Harold. They, of course, were the part owners and the leaders of the American Metal Company before the merger with Climax Molybdenum. From Climax Molybdenum came Frank Coolbore. Mm-hmm. So at that time, the chairman
and McGregor
of AMAX was a junior vice president. The chairman of AMAX was Walter Hochschild, mm-hmm. Harold, a very important board member, and the president chief operating officer was Frank Coolbore.
So and this was a company that was still sort of feeling its
exactly.
way.
Exactly. There mm-hmm. was still a lot of fitting, mm-hmm. well, let's politely say, perhaps infighting going on.
And you were in the middle between...
Well, I was reporting to John Payne, and John right. Payne was not really one of the major decision makers there. It was the Hochschilds, Coolbore, and Gordon Reed, who is on the board, a oil man mm-hmm. of great importance who owned an independent oil company.
But again, sometimes oil and metals are different.
Financially a very important man. And it was Harold Hochschild who said, and this was still in the aftermath, really, to some extent, of the Korean War, he said mm-hmm. he thought it'd be crazy to put a lot of money into a business that depended shipping iron ore through the shipping routes that might be interdicted by Indonesia, by other possible Southeastern Asian
Vietnam.
Entities. Vietnam, as you point out, was very much involved. So there was great threat of instability there mm-hmm. That might interfere with trade from west coast of Western Australia up to Japan. Mm-hmm. And Harold, from all accounts, said no way. So what to do? I mean, there I was in Australia with potentially 100% interest in what looked like becoming a major resource here. And where was the financing going to come from? At the same time, I was aware that there began to be stirrings in the federal government in Australia about Australian ownership in such enterprises. So I went through a list of possible Australian candidates for participation in the process. And the first company I came up with was CSR, Colonial Sugar Refining Company, which happened to own the Whitnum asbestos mine, incidentally. That was about their only interest in mining, but the main interests were the sugar industry in Queensland and in Fiji. In Fiji, CSR was a major factor. And they were into building materials in a big way. They had a second big bow in their quiver, and that was the building materials business. Particularly fiberboard, various plasterboards and so on. They were the major Australian supplier of these products. So one rainy, I forget what it was, maybe that was still in November, 63, November morning, I called Jim Vernon, later Sir James Vernon, who was the chairman of CSR, and asked for an interview, and he said, sure, come on up. And I trudged from my office down on Circular Quay, few hundred yards up to the CSR building, and sat down with Jim Vernon and explained to him that we felt we had a major discovery there, that CSR already had some mining interest in the area, and how about coming in on this project? CSR was known at that time as a very
traditional state, slow-moving company.
But, by golly, it didn't take long
for Jim Vernon and his top lieutenants to realize that they could be onto something here.
And Jim had two right-hand men at the time. And one of them was Don Brown. A chemical engineer by background, a very deliberate man, given to analyzing situations in detail, but a clear thinker and perfectly capable of grasping the importance of the situation. And it was only a matter of weeks, really, before they came back to me and said, yes, indeed, they'd like to examine this opportunity.
They did so. And
now you had to get...
By the middle of 1964, they had committed to taking 45% of the project, and
New York had given its approval of this joint venture.
Did you have to sell this to the board in New York?
I did.
Right.
Yeah.
That gave us the basis for at least reducing the potential financial burden to something that might be manageable in the future. Of course, at that stage, there was no commitment to going ahead and developing this.
But at least it looked as if we had a viable, capable partner. CSR, of course, had a strong engineering group themselves, so they weren't novices to a project like this. In their sugar business and their building materials business, they were operating in some pretty remote parts of Australia and surrounding islands.
So it worked as if they were naive in looking at this project. Just about that time when I first went to CSR was our first wedding anniversary at home, and
I was working 16, 17 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I hadn't provided for a present. So the day before I phoned a florist, said, I'd like to
order some flowers to be delivered
to our apartment. And they said, how much do you want to spend? And I think I said £5, something like that, which at the time was maybe $10. Anyway, the morning of December 22nd, 1963, there was a knock on the door. Outside were two men with their arms full of flowers, and they just said the rest of them in the truck. Cut a long story short, we filled the bathtub totally, plus the sink in the kitchen. Beautiful array of lilies of various kinds, and I forget the names of the others, but cut flowers were certainly cheap in Sydney at that time. So
with CSR more or less in place in the project, we thought the time was ripe, and certainly Charles Court thought the time was ripe, to negotiate the development agreement with the West Australian government. And for this,
John Payne and Andy Chandler
came over, and Don Brown from CSR
was on the team, and we got with Charles Court and his aides, sat down in his office in Perth, and spent 2 or 3 days hammering out an agreement. And I mean hammer out, because there were strong views on both sides. And at one stage, Mr. Court was maintaining that we were being niggardly about the development of this bonanza, so I pulled him up on the term bonanza and said, that's ludicrous to call this at this stage, to call it a bonanza.
Well, that
got him going. We had a very interesting half hour before things calmed down again.
I'm not clear on what the issues were. Was the government to get a return?
Well, the issue was simply this, that we needed title before we could develop this deposit.
Mm-hmm.
And the title was going to be in the form of a 20-year lease, renewable for a further 20 years.
Which you would pay for.
And this this would involve lease payments, which were not particularly onerous, but particularly a royalty on exported ore.
Okay.
And the royalty we negotiated was 7.5% on the FOB price.
But equally importantly, a commitment had to be made to future
processing of the ore, that is upgrading the fines within 10 years to build some kind of a center plant or whatever, or even a reduction plant that would increase the iron content of the material from its natural 63-64%, and might provide upgraded blast furnace feed. And within 20 years to build a steel plant for export. Now, Hammersley had already negotiated an agreement of sorts and had made these commitments. It was impossible to back off, nor did we particularly want to, because, you know, the thought of a quarry ad infinitum was something that was clearly distasteful to the West Australian government without the upgrading to a high value product, and certainly that seemed to be a reasonable point of view. In return, of course, we got secure title. That was the quid pro quo, what we needed, and the commitment by the government to help us with these ancillary facilities, to provide us a right-of-way for the railroad, leases for the port facilities, that is the stockpiling and the port facilities, and so on. Now, at the time, we had only a pretty indefinite view of what shape these other facilities would take.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't really want to spend any more money without
having this clear route to firm title. So we both sides had something to gain. The time was ripe for it. And
the Japanese were not in on these negotiations.
No, not at all.
Not at all.
Now, so the
participants in that agreement at the time were Amex, CSR, and the West Australian government, and of course the deal with Warman and Hilditch sort of underlay that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They were the ones who had the rights to...
I've forgotten the technical term, but
they were the ones who held the temporary permits to explore.
Yeah, but they had the title to those had by then as a result of our deal with them had already passed to Amex.
Okay.
So this was your first experience at this
major project
right.
development.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
mm-hmm.
it was the most exciting time of my life
mm-hmm.
until then. And looking back over the years, probably still is.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned the tunnel that we put into the mountain, and that assay from 54 feet to 538 feet from the portal, 66.8% iron and 0.02% phosphorus, which is just premium grade. And there we started to realize, A, that we were going to be able to make the Japanese a substantial offer, and that we ought really to start engineering the project.
Now, excuse me, you mentioned that 20 years was a little bit thin.
At 100 million tons.
Okay.
So
our reserve estimates increased, and development work progressed.
But you also mentioned that within 20 years you would hope to have a steel plant.
No, that was our
commitment. That's the commitment we made with the West Australian government.
Right.
And that didn't say anything about the rate of production. There was a minimum rate of production specified. Please remember that we were under deadlines that seemed to us immutable. We had to work on several tracks. It would have been nice to do everything in total sequence and have a huge...
Yeah, just switched the tape here.
Okay, so you had 18 months in which to do it.
Another thing we had to do related to the government was with the federal government, because to export iron ore, you have to get a permit from the federal government. So we went to David Fairbairn, who was the Minister for National Development in Canberra, and asked him for a license to export 210 million tons of ore over a period of 21 years. Now, you're going to ask again, why 210? When we only had 100? Well, we were hoping to find more, clearly. But we knew that getting the license would take some time, and we had to do things in parallel rather than in sequence.
We engaged Monsell and Partners out of Melbourne to do preliminary engineering on the project. We, of course, did the mine development plan ourselves for a 5 million ton a year project, but Monsell started to lay out a railroad route to a port, which we nominated to be Port Hedland, and they started to do preliminary engineering on laying out port facilities at Port Hedland. Now that went through many iterations afterwards, but anyway, we got it started. We installed a wave recorder at a place called Cook Point, which was not in the little Port Hedland harbor, but on a headland just to the east of there. And if we were going to have a offshore berth connected to the shore by a trestle, we needed to know what the wave conditions would be in at times of storms. So we installed a wave recorder there at Cook Point. Um,
Now, these other companies were also shipping out of Port Hedland.
No, they weren't.
They weren't.
I'll go into that.
Okay, but, all right.
The answer is no. Sorry. As this work progressed, Monsell's effort were supplemented by other contractors. We got Foley Brothers to study, who's a U.S. railroad contractor, to study the railroad alignment further, and we got Morrison Knudsen out of Boise, Idaho, to study the port facilities. So we started to get more and more people involved. Another thing that began was that we'd invited representatives of Japanese steel companies to come and see what we were doing. And this became a very time-consuming thing, whereby we had to prepare for their visits, and, you know, in the middle of whatever thing we were doing, everybody needed three hands anyway. And here a bunch of these people would arrive in Perth from Yawata and Fuji, and Nippon Kokan and Kawasaki and Sumitomo and Kobe and Nishin and other companies, and they'd arrive in groups of just two or three, or maybe as much as a dozen, and we'd fly them up to Mount Newman, to this very primitive camp we had, and we'd order French cuisine in, put the cook in a white apron and a white hat, and the best of wines, of course, and lay it on. And the Japanese were very, very conscious of the need to have social interaction apart from the technical aspects. So we used to have these dinners there that would start after sun down with the happy hour, quite a lengthy one, and then a formal dinner, and then pressing on into the night to the small hours with a lot of singing. All these Japanese, of course, were very capable singers. You know, that's part of Japanese education, training. They all seem to have good voices and have a wide array of Japanese, but also particularly German drinking songs. And this would always go on until far into the night, and then the following day would be the tours of the exploration of Mount Whaleback and presentations in large numbers and going into a lot of detail. So these visits were quite a undertaking. The Japanese were certainly conscious of what we were doing, and the theory was that by the end of 1964 they would award contracts to Hammersley, Goldsworthy and Mount Newman. That was our wishful thinking. Well, lo and behold, what happened on December 19th of 1964, it was announced that in Tokyo Hammersley had received a contract for 65.5 million tons, Mount Goldsworthy for 16.5 million tons, deliveries to begin in 1966, and for Mount Newman, big fat zero. Well, that, of course, put us into a state of more than mild shock, great disappointment and beating of breasts. Nothing much we could do about it. We went on with our work, and just to deal with that aspect of the project, on May 7th, 8 Japanese steel mills signed a contract for 100 million tons from Mount Hoyleback for 22 years to begin in April of 1969. Well, of course, that was a reason for great celebration at Mount Newman in Sydney, in New York. It was a tremendous achievement. By then, CSR had raised their stake in Mount Newman from 45% to 50%, so they were equal partners with Amex, and we were getting on very, very well with them.
So what had been your response to this announcement that Hammersley and Goldsworthy had contracts and you didn't? What did you do at that point?
Worked like hell, prepared further proposals, and lobbied, and...
Went back to the same people.
Oh, absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you go to Japan at all?
At that stage, I personally did not. I did later, but mm-hmm. at that stage, I didn't. And the actual contact in Japan with the mills were handled by John Payne mm-hmm. and by Michel Carpentier. Michel Carpentier was a potash salesman. You see, Amex's products were sold on the LME and the COMEX and so on, you know, the way metals mm-hmm. are. At least that was the basis to a relatively small group of customers. But potash was the one product that that Amex produced for which there was regional markets. It's a totally different thing selling copper, lead, zinc, gold, silver, or selling these bulk commodities like mm-hmm. potash, iron ore, bauxite, and so on. Because Carpentier had experience in potash, we put him on selling mm-hmm. iron ore in Japan. Now he'd been in the United States forever, but he had a very thick French accent. And he used to come to Sydney and I'd meet with him. He was a guy with a great taste for good French food and so on. And one of his first visits to Sydney, I took him to, I think it was to Doyle's, which is a famous harbourfront restaurant in Sydney. And Pam was with us too. And Michelle ordered filet mignon, and so did I. And the head waiter was an Australian, no-nonsense kind of guy. And when the filet mignon arrived in front of Michelle, he motioned to the head waiter and said, but what is this? He said, I ordered rare, saignant. This is burnt. Didn't look that way to me, but anyway, that's what Michel said. The head waiter said, I see, sir, this is burnt. I'd be very happy to bring you here. Took Michel's plate, and of course I, being with him, being his host, had to evince similar outrage. So took my plate too. And I didn't like the look in the face of the head waiter. Sure enough, about 10 minutes later, he came back. Came in 2 portions of filet mignon. They clearly hadn't been anywhere near any, even a heating device.
Just quivering.
And with very elaborately, he set it down in front of Michel and said, is this to your taste, sir?
And I could see Michel wincing, but he had no option but to say,
ah, yes, that is better. The head waiter went away with a look of triumph on his face.
And Michel had to eat the damn thing, but I refused. I didn't. I took a couple of mouthfuls and went home hungry. So much for Michel.
Anyway, we had the contract in May.
For 100 million tons. And...
I believe we received the export license for 210 million tons from Canberra after several trips to see David Fairbairn, not long after that. Could we pause for 1 minute?
Sure.
Because I'm...
All right, we're continuing after a short break here.
Okay, you know, when I talk about the
contracts with the Japanese steel companies, it is noteworthy that we were not dealing through trading companies, which is the traditional Japanese way of doing business. We had been advised by our Tokyo representative, who is a former major, at least a former
very important executive in the Mitsui combine before the war.
Mr. Fumio Tone. He said, look, the sooner, the more you cut out the trading companies, deal directly with the steel mills, the better off you'll be.
And his advice proved to be absolutely right.
My belief is had we dealt through trading companies, we would not have been successful in getting a contract at that time.
And one interesting thing was that at that time, Iwata and Fuji were still separate companies before
they
joined later on, became Nippon Steel. And the
company that was really in favor of Mount Newman from the Japanese steel companies was Iwata. Fuji was somewhat against.
They were in the CRA camp.
Iwata was very much in our favor. And what had something to do with it was the fact that Katsu Tanaka, who was one of the 79 good men at the PMD1 at Harvard, and I had kept in pretty close touch in the interim. And that may have accounted to some extent why Iwata was favorably disposed towards Mount Newman.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a thread of history through that.
Oh, yes.
As we progressed then and pretty well completed drilling out Mount Whaleback on that 750 foot by 250 foot grid and evaluating the data from by then two tunnels that we'd
put into Mount Whaleback, one
Mount Whaleback East and the other one into the western portion, we developed a model of the geology that differed from that original concept of surface enrichment. And this was largely the work of Ray Martin and Ron McMillan, as I said before. These two young guys started drawing some sections that introduced a concept of deep folding, almost isoclinal folding, and the idea that the high-grade iron ore was concentrated in the in the nodes of these folds.
As opposed to the surface enrichment.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And had a tremendous impact on tonnage potential. And when we reoriented our drilling program to really test this hypothesis, we found that they were right. And our reserve estimate then, we're talking about mid-1965 now, we were already speaking in terms of several hundred million tons, not 100 million tons. We began to believe that in this folding regime, the fold axes dip to the north, and that therefore we should concentrate on the hypothesis that the main ore zone indeed had a steep northerly dip. And I'm jumping ahead here, but by the end of 1965, early 1966,
we could really talk in terms of indicated reserves of the order of 300 million tons
right.
and potential of 900 million tons.
Yeah.
Heady stuff, and I'm talking high-grade hematite. Meanwhile, the engineering was progressing, and Francis Thomas came in as overall manager of the joint venture of Amex and CSR. Now, Francis came from U.S. Steel. He had been general manager on the Orinoco project, the large iron ore mine at Cerro Bolivar in Venezuela. And Francis was an interesting person. He, at Orinoco, I think, had been lord of all he surveyed. He was not one given to detailed work or long hours, and he would not be offended if I said that he liked to manage by instinct and by feel, perhaps, rather than on the basis of detailed study. He was initially very distrustful of Australia and Australians. He was a golf fanatic, and whenever the opportunity arose, he'd be out there trying another golf course. And some of us on the project, including the CSR people, got the impression that he might not be with us terribly long, which afterwards turned out to be correct. But what he did was to bring in a very experienced EPC manager, engineering, procurement, and construction, a man named Gus Werner. And Gus came from a construction company whose name escapes me right now, but there's no question about his credentials, about his experience. He was a big, massive guy, and in my contacts with him, I must admit I learned an awful lot. He had a habit of treating people whom he didn't regard very highly or about whose capabilities he was in doubt pretty roughly, which earned him an unflattering nickname. But I must say that I got on with him very well from our
what
first
was the
meeting.
Nickname?
The nickname was the pig.
Well.
But be that as it may, he knew his business, and he quickly saw that
he could rely on me if I was going to do something for him. We did some crazy things together. For instance, on the railroad route to Mount Newman, and the site of the port still hadn't been to Port Hedland, sorry, mm-hmm. and the site hadn't been fully established. We decided to do a very rough survey. So we got the best maps that were topographic maps that were available and enlarged them and laid out the route
on 8.5 by 11 sheets,
and then spent a whole Saturday morning Xeroxing copies of these roughly 300 sheets because we wanted to have a really detailed scale. So there were Gus and I, you know, working the Xerox machine for 3 hours, the highest paid Xerox operators for a long time. And then we used those for a survey to determine elevations along that route. There's absolutely no data.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did was to establish points at which people were to be dropped with barometers to track the diurnal variation on a consistent basis, and drop these people with helicopters early in the morning, read the whole day, and then at the same pick them up in the evening, and at the same time fly fixed wing up and down all day at constant elevation about above terrain to really tie in the diurnal variation with these individual readings at the sites. Seems pretty complicated, but the concept was fairly sound. And so we all volunteered to man a station there, and this helicopter pilot, who was one of the best pilots and navigators I've ever come across, had the peculiar habit of flying in this hot weather, dressed only in his sandals.
Oh.
But anyway, he dropped us off. I manned one of these stations, and I read this barometer periodically during the day, and the ants got pretty aggressive, and you get these big bull ants there which don't back off when you confront them. And well, all I can say is that it began, daylight began to fade, got darker and darker. I had no food and just a little canister of water which I'd exhausted, and still no helicopter. And it was already almost totally dark when I heard this engine sound and saw this light. And there was Doug, the pilot there, and he scooped me up. He never flew more than about 100 feet above the terrain clearance, and he just took us straight back to the camp. I mean, the guy had an incredible sense of orientation. So anyway, this was just a...
I'm confused about why you needed this data.
To begin to plot the railroad route, yeah, because elevations are all important to determine where the alignment should go to avoid excessive grades with two diesel locomotives hauling maybe 100 ore cars, each laden with 100 tons of ore. So some idea of the elevations was paramount to determine whether the route was at all practicable for a standard gauge railroad, 132-pound rail, standard gauge, 4 foot 8.5. Anyway, this was the beginning of the more detailed engineering. We had preliminary cost estimates of the project as a result of the work that Monsells and Foley and Nim Morrison Knudsen had done, and it came in about $160 million for a project mining, producing 5 million tons a day, hauling, I believe it's about 200 miles to Port Hedland,
building the unloading and stockpiling facilities there, withdrawal from stockpile, ship loading, and the necessary dredging to bring up to 100,000 ton deadweight ton carriers in for loading. Well, this is pretty rough, and we were getting all kinds of noise about rationalization of railroad routes and communal use of ports, because CRA had gone to King Bay,
which is west of Port Hedland, had decided to build the railroad to there.
Mount Goldsworthy was going to Port Hedland, to a little island within Port Hedland, however, called Finucane Island. And the West Australian government said, look, you know, you shouldn't be wasting money on duplicating facilities. Why don't you share the railroad partway with CRA and go to King Bay? And why don't you go to Port Hedland and put your loading facilities at Finucane Island? And we said, yeah, that's a good idea, that's great. But Hammersley didn't want us in the business, CRA, in the terms as they put for sharing their facilities at King Bay were absolutely outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
To wit, $50 million up front, no equity in the facilities, and 50 cents a ton toll.
Mm.
Plus that CRA would maintain all the operating rights. So we had to tell them to get lost very quickly and in no uncertain terms. And Finucane Island was unlikely because to, you know, produce at the volumes that we thought we'd have to load 6,000 tons an hour plus, that matched to the much smaller facilities Goldsworthy was putting in. And then yo-yo small, alternate small carriers, their small car with our big carriers, we felt would lead to congestion and delays. And delays, of course, of vessels waiting outside port, demurrage,
mm-hmm.
It would kill us. So we wanted to go to that offshore Cook Point site, offshore at Port Hedland, about 4 or 5 miles east of Port Hedland. Well, one contribution that Francis Thomas did make to the project was that he thought, rather than going to Cook Point and the risk of being of a vessel being caught in a cyclone, perhaps it'd be better to come into Port Hedland Harbor, but not to Finucane Island, but to a promontory on the opposite side of Port Hedland Harbor called Point Nelson. Now this would require
a huge amount of dredging. I forget how many million yards, about 15 million yards, 20 million yards, I forget the actual quantity. And we said, this is going to add tremendously to the project.
And he said, sure, but I'm convinced this is the way to go. And he brought over
U.S. Steel's shipping expert, Captain Bill Yost, a pretty knowledgeable guy, and he confirmed this. And it didn't take us long to see that this was probably the way to go. Now, there were two aspects to that. It sort of destroyed the West Australian government's desire for some rationalization of facilities, and in addition to that, increased the project cost substantially to over $200 million. And when the first estimate of, I think, about $220 million came in, and by then we'd brought Bechtel into the project to do some engineering for us, everybody went again into
a mild state of shock, as Francis Thomas put it correctly, at the increased cost.
But that's what
it looked like taking. So the upshot of that then was
that
I again began to think in terms of maybe another partner for the joint venture. And the people that I got in touch with over that was BHP, Broken Hill Proprietary. And they came to the project site
surprised that they weren't already involved in one of these other.
You are absolutely right. The light dawned on them very late in the process.
Right.
Other people,
Lee, had the same question.
Hmm.
Why on earth
weren't they in on this much earlier in the process?
If you'll excuse me one minute,
I've got to check a date here.
BHP came to the project site in May of 1966, paid the first visit. They had had, that is their top management, they had sent some mining engineers and geologists before, and they adhered to the old surface enrichment theory
And even with the evidence put right in front of them, they wouldn't acknowledge that the major tonnage potential had been demonstrated. And I think this ties into your question just a minute ago, why hadn't they been there before? It was very difficult for them to admit that here was something with major potential that they had missed.
But on May 14th, 1966, Ian McLennan, who is the chairman of BHP, later Sir Ian McLennan, Jim McNeil, his chief financial officer, who later succeeded him as chairman, as Sir James McNeil, Bill Sweetland, their chief engineer, they came to the Mount Newman camp. We
had a large dinner with them that